in the church. And we can do everything we can to reduce the risk, but we just simply can't eliminate it completely. So we need to be prepared for when abuse actually occurs. So first, we want to think about the issue of reporting. Every state in the U.S. has clear reporting laws that outline what must be done when someone suspects abuse. Yet, so many churches fail to report. So why don't more adults actually speak up, especially when they suspect there might be abuse occurring? A few suggestions. Sometimes adults don't report because of their own pride and arrogance, thinking things like, we can't handle this problem. We can't handle this problem on our own. Or the world has nothing to offer us. Or doubts or uncertainty slow people down. Maybe a person sees the signs of abuse but denies or rationalizes the problem away. And if the accused has a good reputation in the community, it's hard to see an accusation sticking. It's much easier to minimize the complaint. There can be a concern for harming someone's personal reputation, even if the charges are false. Once public allegations are made, the person can be labeled for a very long time as an abuser. There can be a concern for the reputation of the organization. If they report abuse, it will tarnish their witness in the community, or people might stop coming and stop giving financially, or might be fearful of legal consequences because of their poor choices. All of these forces work together to make churches feel like it's not worth taking the risk of reporting abuse. Some might even argue that reporting will actually make things worse. If a child or teenager shared with the allegations of abuse, don't let your doubts or fears or concerns slow you down. A helpful phrase to remember is, resolve doubts in favor of reporting. Even if church members or leadership of the church disagree with the need to report, a responsible Christian who has reasonable suspicion about abuse will report to police or CPS. It's important to understand that there are criminal penalties for failing to report. Protections afforded with legal and civil litigation if report is actually made in good faith. When we talk about reporting, it's important to clarify the difference between mandatory and permissive reporters. When I first entered the subject, this was probably the most confusing thing to me because it felt like everybody said something different. So here's my attempt to just even clarify what it is. In hearing of witnessing and suspecting abuse, a mandatory reporter is someone who, by law, must, and that's the key word in the whole sentence, must report it to police or Child Protective Services. So mandatory reporters usually include categories of people like school teachers, daycare workers, police officers, doctors, nurses, licensed counselors, and actually in some states, the laws have now required clergy to be mandatory reporters. What standard do we use to decide if we're going to report or not report? Many might think you need to have concrete proof, absolutely no doubt. We've got all the evidence necessary, and therefore we will report. Or at least be certain about the abuse before you report. But that sets the standard way too high. Rather than waiting until you have reasonable cause to report, you should report as soon as there's reasonable suspicion. To help define that latter term, a child safety expert Beth Swagman says that a person has reasonable suspicion when, quote, and you see that there, a reasonable person seeing a similar bruise or hearing a similar story would come to a similar understanding about the probable cause of the bruise or assault. Reasonable suspicion does not imply actual knowledge or certainty, as in, I know what happened. Instead, reasonable suspicion suggests that reasonable people have sufficient general knowledge of appropriate and inappropriate interactions to be suspicious about a particular incident. End quote. Permissive reporters, on the other hand, essentially include everyone who is not a mandatory reporter. A permissive reporter is someone who, upon hearing of, witnessing, or suspecting abuse, is not legally mandated to report, but may choose to report. And that word may is the most important word in that sentence. But I would argue that if a Christian has reasonable suspicion that a child abuse has occurred, he or she must report. A believer has a higher moral and ethical standard than the law creates, and thus is under the same obligation as a mandatory reporter to do something about the abuse. Responsibility is not just a matter of being a good citizen, whatever the society would require me to do according to its laws. Responsibility as a Christian primarily means doing what God asks of us, which in the case of child abuse would mean doing everything we could to protect children. In the end of time, we will stand before God and look back on our lives. What we would hate to find out is that children continued to be abused because we didn't do anything. And to hear God's rebuke, why didn't you do anything about the abuse? A few other things that churches should remember in regards to reporting. Every church should have a designated contact person, someone who is ready to receive and respond to the allegations of abuse. Where there is a contact person, anyone with knowledge and reasonable suspicion of abuse should immediately reach out to this person and talk through the relevant information. If the abuse occurs in the context of the church, the person who has reasonable suspicion of abuse usually needs to talk with both church officials and civil authorities, although it's possible for a church to be so corrupt that the person would just need to go directly to police or CPS. Why is it important to talk to both, if possible? Take the example of one of the many single people in our church who don't have much or any experience with children, who volunteer in children's ministry, so a large portion of our volunteer force are single people who are helping out, but they can't distinguish between a really bad rash and a bruise because of abuse. They might see something while changing a diaper, and if they rush to report it, they might cause unnecessary harm on everyone's part, which is something we could have avoided if they just simply talked to the children's ministry director. If the person talked with the church's designated point of contact, it should not be presumed that it's now the church's responsibility to report the abuse. A responsible Christian who witnesses, suspects, or hears of abuse should also promptly report it to civil or governing authorities. Churches often try to conduct their own investigations in order to decipher the legitimacy of abuse claims, but as I stated earlier, initially, that shouldn't be the role of the church. Church investigations too often make things worse, not actually better. Police are responsible for investigating allegations of abuse and then turning them over to a prosecutor who decides if there's enough evidence to bring a charge against an alleged abuser. CPS is responsible when the well-being of the child, is compromised. They don't involve themselves in the actual prosecution of an abuser. CPS's main concern is to make sure the child is safe, and if not, to place them in a context where abuse cannot be continued. So you should call police or CPS or whatever the agency is in charge of the welfare of children in this area in any of the following cases. The child is related to the abuser and lives with the abuser. The child is being abused by a non-relative at home. The child's safety is at risk and the parents are not actually protecting the child. Engage the local police department in the following cases. The child does not know the abuser. The child is not related to the abuser and does not live with the abuser. The child may have contact with a non-relative abuser without protection. And the child is under the authority of a non-relative abuser at a location other than home, like at a church or at a summer camp. If a person is not sure if he or she has reasonable suspicion or grounds to report, it is good to talk over that situation with legal counsel. Or one of the things I think is actually most useful that most people don't realize, you can anonymously call CPS, give the details of the situation, and ask for their counsel on what they think is best to do. So you can get direct feedback from them without actually having to give over the details and do an official report. If the authorities decide not to do anything, the church may still need to investigate, especially if there is a possibility of alleged abuse continuing, and especially an alleged abuser continuing to harm children. For example, a missionary who comes from overseas, and there are allegations of abuse about that missionary, him or her, in working in a foreign country. Well, your local police department is not going to do that investigation because the incidents that occurred are not under their jurisdiction. In which case, you're left in a really awkward position. The government authorities may not do anything about it then. And yet your church is irresponsible if your church decides to not do anything in figuring out whether there was actually abuse that occurred. A church can choose to conduct an internal investigation and actually even hire outside experts to do an investigation. Conducting an internal investigation could actually prevent that church and even that denomination from future liability. If the authorities decide that they're not going to pursue a report, it's also advisable for the church to keep written records or a log of the allegations to document any reports made to police and CPS, and if the children are still in the congregation, to do their best to continue a relationship with the children. The signs and symptoms of abuse, if they increase in frequency, the church will need to make the report again to police and CPS. Now, no matter how much work is involved in sorting through an abusive situation, the church needs to be continually mindful of caring for victims. As soon as allegations are revealed and authorities are contacted, care of a child or a teenager needs to be an immediate concern for the church. Too often, churches let victims and their families struggle on their own, especially after the initial crisis has passed and investigation has begun, and yet months later, nobody's paying attention to the victim. Sometimes this is because churches can be at a loss on how to help, especially if they have not encountered abuse before. Over the long term, victims need to feel the church's support in many ways. But in the short term, best thing that a pastor or the staff or the members can do is, you know what? Just simply listen. Just simply take the time to listen. The wounds of abuse are deep. So it'll take a lot of love, a lot of dealing honestly with the harm that has occurred, a lot of patience in dealing with the person who was abused. Let the victims tell their stories and be patient with them. Be a part of what is going to be a long-term healing process as they engage the deep difficulties of abuse in their life. Pastors, staff, and church members should be careful and thoughtful in how they speak to victims. They should not give the child or teenager religious platitudes or quick superficial application of scripture. At some point in speaking to victims, they should also make very clear a moral declaration that the abuse was wrong, that it was wrong, and that to encourage the victim that speaking up was scary, but it was the right thing to do. The church also needs to be mindful of the victim's family. You know, I think one of the most overlooked parts of the healing process is actually caring for everyone else in the family. If there's a particular child who was abused, there's going to be counseling and investigations and just a lot of attention. And yet there's other siblings in the home. They need to know how to deal with this. They need to know in the midst of all the chaos that has ensued what to do. Or there are parents dealing with the guilt of feeling like they haven't protected the child. And just the work that you need to do to help them through this process. So sometimes our focus can be so on the victim and protecting against liability that we lose sight of the rest of the family. In an age of fast food and quick fixes, leaders and fellow church members might wonder why counseling and dealing with these issues takes so long. The church needs to recognize that in dealing with the trauma of abuse, healing will take time, and no one can rush this kind of process. The pastor and church need to be committed to care for the victim over the long haul. Two suggestions, two roles that are important in caring for a victim over the long haul, especially in facilitating the church's care of these victims. The first is that of a church advocate. What's a church advocate? Well, it's someone who keeps tab on the victims, who will be on the front lines of caring for the victims. This person will help harness the resources of the church to show support throughout the process. So whereas the leadership will be involved and very engaged, especially in the initial stages, we move to a place of months later where they don't have as much direct contact with the victim. And yet what they've done wisely is they've asked someone in the congregation to be the advocate on behalf of that victim, to be involved in the counseling sessions, to be regularly checking in on them weekly, to be praying with them regularly, to be just in contact with them. And that advocate ends up being a liaison with the leadership, educating them as to how things are going, helping them understand issues as they come to play over the course of time, keeping them in some way connected to the victim and the family, so that later on, the victim doesn't say things like, "You forgot about me. Nobody cares anymore." And so it's a huge service to leaders, because honestly, months later on, they've got so many other things they also have to deal with, and yet they don't want to lose sight just simply out of busyness of the victim. And it's a huge service to the victim, because there's somebody whose designated role in the church is to advocate for them, especially someone who has a good relationship with the leadership of the church. So if there's a particular need that shows up months later, the advocate is the one who gets on the phone and says to the pastor, "Hey, it's been a while, but I just want to update you, and this is a way that the church can help." So I think that's actually one of the best strategies, especially moving out of the initial stages of the news emerging and the initial crisis and all the energy around it, to actually maintain long-term care and make sure the church keeps tabs on what's going on with the victim and the victim's family. The second is a counselor. In picking a counselor, you want to make sure you pick someone who has experience in treating abuse. One expert has warned, an incompetent counselor may be worse than no counselor at all. Now, if you look at the news, you often see stories about large settlements when victims sue churches and other organizations that were negligent. The sad irony of this all is victims don't want lawsuits. It might look like that because that's what we read in the news. They don't want large monetary settlements. But they actually feel compelled to pursue legal recourse because churches ignore them. Churches minimize the abuse. Churches even fight against them. So what's happening? Most victims are more interested in hearing an apology, seeing the abuser brought to justice, and witnessing genuine reform in the church so this never happens to anyone else again. Kelly Clark, I remember him, an account I read by him in talking about the fact that there was one young man who had been abused in a very difficult situation. And so he represented him in prosecuting the organization that wouldn't deal with him. And so once they got through the initial legal matters and the organization was now willing to work with him, the guy was really aggressive in pushing Kelly to get them to reform their policies. He didn't care about the money. He cared that nobody, that it wouldn't happen to anybody else in that organization like it had happened to him. Lawyer and child abuse expert Kelly Clark, who has prosecuted dozens of Christian institutions on the issue of child abuse, had said that non-monetary responses by a church, such as an apology from leaders, symbolic gestures like a garden dedicated to abuse survivors, and face-to-face dialogue with leaders, all can do tremendous good in bringing about healing for victims. The temptation is to prioritize the needs of the church over the needs of victims. If the church takes a defensive posture in protecting itself against possible lawsuits or increased liability, often engagement with the victim will be a very low priority, and in many cases, actually non-existent. So let me be clear. Care for the victim should be a high priority. Now, trial lawyer Kelly Clark argues that it actually is possible for the church to do the smart thing of protecting itself and the right thing in caring for the needs of victims. In fact, the church that takes care of the needs of the victim first, what, quote, they will find is that it goes better for them after that, end quote. Clark states that if churches care for the needs of the victims first, quote, it takes all the venom out of the situation. The victim no longer has a need or basis to vilify, end quote, the church. And then in regards to communicating with the church, how should church leaders and staff communicate information about abuse to the congregation? The decision of when to communicate with the congregation can often be tied to restrictions put on by different parties involved, including legal counsel. The appropriate time for communicating to parents in the congregation can vary, from after the initial complaint all the way to the completion of the investigation. And wisdom's needed in discerning when do you say something, what's the best timing, what do you say. But there are two wrong approaches to this issue of communication. Either saying nothing to the church, or actually telling the church everything in explicit detail. The former, saying nothing to the church, is actually going to, when it actually emerges later on, to be deeply troubling to parents. And the latter is actually going to be reckless, telling every detail conceivable. Neither approach is really appropriate. The legal concern is the possibility of a lawsuit over defamation or invasion of privacy. The idea of qualified privilege is instructive here. Church leaders may talk with the congregation about a specific child abuse situation because a qualified privilege protects, and this is a quote, communications made in good faith on any subject matter in which the person communicating has an interest or in reference to which he has duty, if such communication is made to the person having a corresponding interest and duty, end quote. Well, that's legal mumbo jumbo. What does that actually mean? Church leaders can communicate with the congregation about abuse because members have relevant interest in the matter. That's basically what it means, especially when it comes to care and protection of their own children. if the church leader communicating with the church knows what he is saying is false or shares the information recklessly without any regard to truth or the falsity of it, then the leader and the church are liable for defamation and invasion of privacy. The key is to this qualified privilege is to communicate only to the members because they're the people who have the direct interest in knowing about it. To that end, there are two ways to communicate about specific abuse with the congregation. First, church leaders send a letter directly to the members of the congregation. The letter should fall under the parameters of qualified privilege if it's sent only to members, it's marked confidential, and limited to explaining only the facts of the situation. Second, leaders can discuss the matter in some kind of context like a members' meeting. The same parameters would apply, members only, and the leaders sharing only facts of the situation, not speculation or that leader's personal opinion. If you're involved in carrying out this communication with the church, don't identify the victim unless the victim, he or she, asks to be identified. Help the church understand what happened, but only tell the church what is necessary. Help them to understand that the leaders have responded immediately, that the victim is safe and is getting help, that authorities are investigating the alleged perpetrator. Encourage other victims to come forward if they've been abused by this person or anyone else. Because remember, often perpetrators have dozens of victims. So who knows but that someone else has also been affected and you don't know about it yet. Because gossip is a frequent problem with Christians, church leaders and staff members need to be careful to maintain appropriate confidentiality. If the information is shared with the membership, the members should be warned about the confidentiality. Everything should be handled with great care and consideration toward the victim, the accused, and their families. Any means employed by the church to communicate with its members should also be reviewed by the church's legal counsel. Consider the story of Vienna Presbyterian Church and the aftermath of the abuse scandal involving the former student ministries director, Eric. From 2001 to 2005, Eric was the youth minister for the church's growing youth group, and the church was thrilled as he did a great job in mentoring and connecting with youth. But public appearances can actually often be deceiving. At the very same time, under a cloud of secrecy, Eric had initiated intimate relationship with girls in the youth group. He got involved romantically. He professed his love and desire to get married to them. And as they grew older, he started initiating sexual contact with them. One of the girls actually tried to come forward, but was basically ignored. Several others, the church's response made it very difficult to report actually what happened. Eric, on the other hand, when the news broke about the allegations, received encouragement from many members of the church, including support during the trial, help moving out of his condominium, financial gifts from members. Some church folks even blamed the girls outright, implying that it was their fault. They claimed that it would be hard for a young man to resist the temptations of these young women. In 2008, Pastor David Jordan Haas joined the church staff, and even though it had been several years, he recognized the wrong that had been done and sought to rectify the situation, even though time had passed. The church formed an abuse outreach ministry in 2009, and soon afterward, for the very first time, heard the full story of one of the women who had been led astray by the former student ministries director. The process culminated with the church actually going public about the situation, taking ownership of the wrong done, and apologizing to the victims. On March 27, 2011, Senior Pastor Peter James preached a sermon on sexual abuse to the congregation at Vienna Presbyterian Church. Turning to a group of young women who had been abused by Eric, Pastor James stated, quote, We failed as leaders to extend the compassion and mercy that you needed. Some of you felt uncared for, neglected, and even blamed for this abuse. I am sorry. And the church is sorry. End quote. If a church owns its mistakes and apologizes, it risks legal challenges, increased liability, and for some churches, possible financial ruin. Vienna Presbyterian Church took a very bold move in going public, but not everyone was happy about their decision. As you might expect, there were some in the congregation that were really upset about this whole thing. But unexpectedly, the insurance provider gave them significant pushback as well. On March 23, 2011, a lawyer hired by the company Guide One Insurance sent a warning to the church officials, quote, "Do not make any statements orally or in writing or in any matter to acknowledge, admit to, or apologize for anything that may be evidence of or interpreted as a suggestion that the actions of the Vienna Presbyterian Church caused to or contributed to any damages arising from the intentional acts, abuse, misconduct by the youth director," end quote. Horrendous. Absolutely horrendous. But think about the church's response. In a letter sent to the congregants the very next day, the church's governing board took a different course. The letter stated, quote, "Members of staff and of this session are profoundly sorry that VPC's response after the abuse was discovered was not always helpful to those entrusted to our care," end quote. And then in a sermon on March 27, Pastor James took things one step further, asserting, "We won't hide behind lawyers. Jesus said the truth will set us free," end quote. Many churches just won't follow Vienna Presbyterian Church's example. Most churches let legal and liability restrictions dictate how they'll respond to abuse cases. The Christian tenets of openness and truthfulness create greater liability in a judicial world. So says James McCalman, whose company often helps insurers by showing churches how to set up abuse prevention programs. What church insurers want most is to limit liability. McCalman explains the insurance company has a contract with the church that says, if we're going to put our assets on the line, we want you to perform in a way that protects our assets and our interests. This put churches in a defensive posture. The priority is given to protecting oneself rather than rectifying the wrongs done within a church. As Pastor Jordan Haas would say in the wake of the abuse scandal, quote, "We really seek to change institutionally and relationally, and that comes at a cost," end quote. Most churches are willing to risk the costs as they face the very real possibility of incurring legal damages they couldn't afford to pay, bankruptcy, and the demise of the church. What then is the response for a church? Should legal and liability restrictions set the agenda for the church's response? And if not, what should set the response for the church? What should be their agenda? Those are some of the questions that really every church has to wrestle with as something like this emerges in their congregation and they decide how they're going to respond to abuse. Finally, if a sexual offender is called to your church and wanted to come, what would you do? Do you let him come to church, or should you actually keep him off the property? How do you protect the kids while he's actually in the building? interesting questions you need to consider if a sexual offender comes to your church. If a sexual offender does come, four things that I think a church should do if a known abuser shows up. Number one, first, the church should be prepared to have a member shadow the offender at all times when he or she is on church premises. The escort should ensure that the offender does not engage with children or teenagers, nor visit the children's ministry or youth ministry classes. If the offender returns to church, he or she should be contacted and alerted that he or she is not allowed to be at church without a chaperone. And based on the history and the nature of the past abuse, some churches actually have considered establishing a separate service just for the offender. At another location, with select members from the church being a part of that service. That allows the church to prioritize the protection of the children and also finds ways to meet the spiritual needs of the offender. Number two, someone on staff should contact the offender's parole officer in the local prosecutor's office to find out what specific terms his or her probation. It's important to understand the terms of the offender's probation so that the church can abide by the law. For example, if the offender is not allowed in public settings with children, the church should contact the offender and make clear to him or her that the church will not actually violate the law. Number three, as soon as possible, someone should review court documents and other records to verify the offender's past offenses. It would not be unusual for a child abuser to lie or to cover up aspects of past offenses. The church should verify from other sources what really happened. And then number four, if the offender continues to attend, the parents in the church should be informed. The parents should be told so they can decide what level of supervision is appropriate for protecting their children. What if the sexual offender keeps coming and eventually asks to join the church? How should the church deal with that, with him or her? Assuming that you followed all of the above recommendations I just made for the sexual offender who's visiting a church, a couple more steps can be taken. The church should have some process to evaluate if the offender or any visitor who's requesting to join is born again. Just because someone says they're a believer doesn't mean they're necessarily regenerate or born again. A lot of people live as Christians by name only. And in the case of sexual offenders, they lie deliberately in order to gain access to children. So the point of the membership process that I described earlier is to create a way for visitors to join the church where the visitor's oriented to the expectations of being a member, but the pastor also is given an opportunity to evaluate if the visitor is truly born again. Now, polity, that is the way the leadership is structured within a church and the way the church organizes itself, requires that the elders or sessions of the church protect the front doors such that the church is made up of regenerate believers, people who are genuinely born again. There are plenty of offenders who can fake it. They can lie their way into churches, especially if they grew up in church. So they know the language, they know the Bible verses, they know how to say the right things. So this is not obviously foolproof. But, as we mentioned in the first hour, it is one of the tools in our arsenal to protect against abusers. But another way to evaluate the legitimacy of someone's conversion is during the process of integrating this person in the church. Does the offender understand the consequences of his sin, and is he willing to accept them, or does he act or look more worldly in his behavior? Let me create a contrast for you in this regard. We actually had an offender come, attend, and join the congregation. And so I'm not talking about this in the abstract. This is all the things that we're doing in regards to actually having an offender in our congregation. You know, when I interacted with the offender as he came and joined and was visiting and then all the different things that went on, he had no reluctance when I approached him at different points and said, well, I'm going to notify the congregation about you being an attender at the church. I'm especially going to send out a letter to parents. I'm going to make sure the church understands the attendance and the policies we're implementing. I'm going to make sure the church understands the background story of it. He had no reluctance. In fact, his reaction was something like, that's to be expected considering the wrong I've done in my past. Now, consider, in contrast, one of our sister churches where an offender showed up, and when the pastor said the same kind of things, and the person got deeply angry, argumentative, and didn't want any of that. Well, I just offer that to you. Luke chapter 6, Jesus says, we recognize a tree by its fruit. I think I know a lot about those two different men's hearts by the fruit that was born in their heart responses to what the pastors asked to be able to do in order to properly equip the church. I'm much more suspicious of the latter guy as pretending compared to the former guy. Granted, that's just one bit of data. One bit of data, and you have to judge someone in the overall context of their life. But that's instructive. Helps us to understand more as we consider what it means to integrate this person within our church. After all this, if you decide to let the offender join, you should have the offender agree to and sign a code of conduct. The conduct guidelines should require that the offender do the following. Agree to a thorough background check, verify any details of past abuse, allow church leaders to disclose this information to the congregation, refrain from any communication or activities with children or teens, both inside and outside the church, be accompanied by a chaperone whenever the offender is at church. Church staff should warn the offender that any violation of these terms could result in our congregation, and with our polity, we actually believe the Bible's words about church discipline. And so we would excommunicate, remove that person from the church, and possibly even bar them from the church. And so the child abuser's consent to these items, I think, should be in writing. So there's no question of that person agreeing to the terms in which the church leadership has set for his participation and then his joining the congregation. Have the child abuser agree to the church's prioritizing also of the needs of the abused. If the offender is genuinely repentant of his or her sins, 2 Corinthians 7, verses 9 to 11, it should be evidence in his or her willingness to defer to the needs of the victims. For example, if the victim does not feel safe in the same building with the offender should be willing to find a different church. This would allow the victim to remain behind and actually feel safer in church. But if the offender is not willing to defer to the needs of the victim, again, there's a data point for me. It tells me a lot about the offender and their understanding of the gravity of their own sin and the consequences of it. So we want to, as I said earlier, we want to always, always, always prioritize the needs of the victim. So some of you that might face the difficult circumstances of both the victim and the offender in the same congregation are going to walk this awkward tightrope of actually learning how to deal with both. The reality is, if there is an offender, you need to figure out how to minister to that person too, because they have a soul and they need to be reconciled back to God. But you want to at the same time prioritize the needs of the victim because of the evil that was done against them. And so A lot of wisdom is needed in order to figure out how to do both if they both choose to remain within the congregation. Well, that's basically the main things I wanted to say then in terms of prevention. Do we need a brief break, or do you want to just go ahead and go into the Q&A? You want to go ahead and do a Q&A? Okay, let's go ahead and do that. That might let us get out even earlier. So, questions all the way in the back. And always, whoever I call on, tell me your... Oh, wait, I forgot one part. Hold on. The most important part. If you're walking away feeling more concerned that a child abuser might harm your children, that's probably a good thing. The realities of child abuse are deeply, deeply disturbing. But they should motivate us to take seriously the protection of children in our churches. However, far be it from me to end on a note of fear. My goal here is not to be a fearmonger. As Christians, where does our hope finally come from? In nothing that we can do in this world, but in the God of grace who equips us to walk in wisdom and in strength. As followers of Christ, we must live not in fear, but in trust in God. We should serve our children and our churches with the same confidence that David had when he wrote about it, when he faced his own trials and difficulties. When I am afraid, I put my trust in you. In God, whose word I praise, in God I trust, and I am not afraid. What can mere mortals do to me? Psalm 56, verse 3 and 4. And then that last slide... You each church got a copy of my book On Guard there for you to be able to take home and read in more detail things I hit on, so that you'll have a lot more information through the book. And then there's multiple appendices in there to actually add in further information. But the other book I thought was just hugely helpful, and I quoted her a couple of times today, but many times in the book, is Beth Swagman's Preventing Child Abuse, which is a useful resource. She'll do some things that I didn't cover in the book. Like, she goes into much more extensively categories like bullying. In regards to the child protection policy, she has a whole chapter that actually even has the actual language and phrases that you can consider adopting within your protection policy to help with all the phone calls we've received in regards to child protection policies and the kind of language and how to do it. We've posted on our website, so capitalhillbaptist.org, three examples of child protection policies so that you can download for free. So there's a policy of a smaller Lutheran church, so the kind of small church example. There's ours, the kind of mid-sized church, the 500 to 1,000 level. And then there's a multi-site, multi-thousand church policy also. And they're all there, and I've got permission from all of them to post them so that you can download them for free and then actually read them and then adjust them and learn from them. We read through dozens and dozens of policies, and not only our rewriting of our own policies, but also then obviously in preparation of the book. So these are the three that we picked out just as examples for you in just different sized churches that you can go and take for yourself to help you in the process that you're doing. Now, keep in mind in the appendix, when I have that quick guide on writing a policy, I quote Beth in saying, don't just take someone else's policy and fill in your church's name. That's just not helpful, because your policy needs to be tailored to the specifics of your own church. So I commend these policies to you, because in reading them, you can learn a lot about how best to write your own policy. Even adopt portions like language or phrasing, cover things that maybe you didn't think to cover. in your own setting in terms of your own policies. So questions about anything, and I know we had a couple of questions that last break, and tell me your name and even your church context so I know where you're coming from. Okay, great.
So in screening volunteers, I noticed there's a question on your application that says, it asks about the history of abuse in the volunteer's life. So could you just talk about kind of your pastoral heart behind asking that question and then potential responses?
Yeah. Yeah. In our screening application, we put that there because of the reality that abuse can be generational. So it's a sensitive subject to bring up. It's a hard conversation to have. And I want to be very, very gentle with that person. You know, I'd say almost like 99 times out of 100, what I'm encountering is the person is even more vigilant to protect children because of what they've been through. But because there is that 1 out of 100 that I feel like I'm countering, I still have to have the conversation. Just the reality of just even the studies that document how abuse is multi-generational within a family. So the father abused ends up creating a child who, when they grow up as an adult, has a propensity to actually abuse. And so we want to just actually be wise in potentially cutting that off. Which is the reason why. But, you know, in contrast to other things, which I might be more aggressive in the conversation, in opening up and probing and sorting through, this I'm just going to be very careful and very gentle in my handling of the person, show a lot of mercy and sympathy. But I will ask the direct questions, specifically related to children's ministry, like, so what is your disposition towards children? Has the abuse affected you such that you have any propensity to harm children? Do you have any of those kinds of temptations? I need to open it up and ask because of the screening procedures and just making sure. Is that what you're looking for, Kelly? Just understanding that? Okay, good. Other questions? Yes, and tell me your name again.
Chad.
Chad. Yeah, our policy does state that we have discretionary judgment to actually basically say no to someone. And I want that ability in order to be able to, otherwise, what's the point of screening? Like, why am I doing this in the first place? Well, in that regard, we've tried to state it clearly in the policy, so it's not a surprise. But, you know, people don't always read the policy. People are not paying attention all the time. So they get to that conversation. And what's hard in that conversation is them walking away with guilt and shame, feeling like they're not allowed to be with the children. That's really the harder part, pastorally, in having that conversation.
Has it ever been a problem when they go out angry, wanting to create some sort of strife?
Yeah, I mean, in our setting right now, our congregation is a really good place in terms of the membership and the unity. So there might be people disgruntled with me, especially based on their maturity and their place in life. I expect more immature people to actually not like this at all. But that's a part of me actually being the firewall, being able to say no on behalf of the church. And, you know, there's a personal reality to this. My kids are in there. So, you know, I put the picture of our family there because I got five children. I'm helping to populate our children's ministry. So if I'm careless about this, it affects my own direct children. But yeah, I mean, people will come out disgruntled on things like that. That's the heart. Well, no, it's a really good question. That's why when you write a child protection policy, you do, based on the laws in your own area, you do want to make sure legal counsel reviews it so that they're on board with what you're doing and they sign off on it. You want to also make sure that the leadership is on board with it so that when that disgruntled person goes to the leadership and says, how dare they reject me from children's ministry over this, whatever it is, that the leadership is on board that with a screening process that actually says no. I mean, fortunately, the vast majority of people were just like, yep, come on down. Join our happy and clappy world. We're excited for you to come and have access to the kids. And, you know, in our context, in a highly transitional environment where we lose 15 to 20% of volunteer force every year, I mean, we're constantly trying to have to replace with new volunteers. So we have to do the hard work. Some of you are in those contexts where you have a Sunday school teacher who's committed to teaching for like 20 years in that classroom. Oh, I would love that. Oh, to have something like that, where they feel like their calling in the church is to get in there and say, teach Sunday school to the sixth graders. Until the Lord calls them home. I love that. I wish I had more of that. But no, actually, we face more often. And I feel more the need to be vigilant because of the transition. To actually be on top of this and have the conversations. So, yes. Yeah, that's an excellent question. Yeah, so excellent question on pushback, not wanting to do these things, especially from leadership or the rest of the congregation. This is where, you know, my warnings at the very beginning of that second lecture was, keep in mind your context. Remember, this is my ideal. You might not be able to do all of this right away. And now having done this and written this, I hear all kinds of churches report all kinds of things in regards to the anger or confusion or pushback that comes when you try to do this. So, first line of approach to this is after you equip yourself in understanding the issues, I think is go to the leadership. I think you go to the leadership and you only go as far as they're willing or ready to do. But once they sign on board and they're ready, and that means you have to patiently take the time to equip them. It may mean not just one conversation. It may mean many conversations. It may mean sending them a link to the audio from the talks today and saying to them, hey, RTS has made the audio free. Do you want to listen to it sometime this week? You can just listen to it while you're cutting the lawn or doing other things like that. And see if they'll take the time. Just be kind to them by being patient with them, recognizing they're busy, they've got a lot to do. And most of the leaders we're thinking about are godly people who want to do the right thing. In which case, you be patient in equipping them, because nobody, I mean, I bring this up because I didn't hear this about this in seminary. I mean, I didn't have a class that explicitly equipped me with this. And so our children's ministry team was at a loss. The whole reason I first wrote this is because when we started looking at it, we couldn't find the things we felt like we needed. It was like a hodgepodge of things out there, and everything we could find was out of print. So the only reason I did this is because I felt like, oh, there's a huge void. Somebody's got to step in the gap and do that. So, you know, hand them the book and say, you don't have to read the whole thing. Just read chapters like 4 is the scary chapter because it's the predator chapter. But, you know, 5 on why churches respond this way. And then maybe 6 on child protection policy is just as a beginner in thinking about it. But once you get the leadership on board, then you look towards, with the leadership, equipping the congregation. And it's the same thing. You take it slow. You go just as far as the congregation is ready. And not to say that then you can go with all 8 of the prevention strategies. You might be able to just even go with 1 or 2. And over the course of time, with the leadership's permission and the congregation growing and understanding this issue, be able to add in more. And when you get the pushback of potentially adding any of these 8 things, well, the leadership then has to be behind you. Be willing to make some sacrifices for the sake of actually protecting the children. What you just don't want is the horror story of everything comes into place because a child was abused. And then suddenly everybody cares. Thoughts on that? Is that what you're looking for? Okay. Other questions? Yeah, sir.
Yeah.
And tell me your name.
Steve.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm from a country church down in South Carolina, and we have teachers that teach for 20 years.
Yeah.
So if you implement a policy like this, when you start doing background checks, do it on everybody so that everybody's covered, or you just start with new people coming in?
Yeah, I said my ideal. I think you do it on everybody. But in your context, it's going to be harder. Because you will get the, I've been doing this for 20 years. Why do a background check right now? Well, that's where, you know, even the younger folk can begin to set the example. When they readily say, yeah, this is the best thing for our kids. But that's part of the other conversation too. Being able to say to them, you know, young families want to make sure we're being wise. If you want young families to stick around, we need to do some of these things. Yeah, that's wonderful. Yeah. Yeah, so the question being, if you hadn't heard it, about in the church, if you've got folks who've been around for 20 years and the resistance you get, leadership, elders, deacons, staff can set the example and say this is important. We've set within our policy now, actually, whether staff members have contact or no contact with children, everybody that is actually a part of paid staff is just going to get the background checked as a smarter way to actually do prevent greater liability within our church setting. And that's an opportunity to set the example. And so when the senior pastor is able to say, all of our staff did it, whether we work with children or not, because we think this is a wise way to make sure we protect the children. So, and, you know, the pastoral appeals are, you know, everybody likes having children in the church. Everybody likes the little kids with happy voices and running around in the energy. But not everybody wants to do the hard work of keeping families. So that's part of the appeal. But I'd say to you, what position are you in at the church? Okay, you're an elder. Yeah, it's especially as the session, the eldership speaks up. That's important. It's one thing if the children's minister says something, but when the senior pastor or the eldership says, this is important to our church, and the leadership is willing to take some of the cost that comes when people gripe and complain or actually even refuse. There will be some people who will say, yeah, if I got to do a background check, I'm not going to teach anymore. Well, that's part of the cost that you need to be willing to undertake in doing some of the things like this. But again, I'm going to keep cautioning. Take it slow. equip the church first. Give them a chance to understand. I always want to presume the best of people by teaching them well, instructing them in the Word, being patient by having conversations with them, letting them grow in their understanding, rather than just, bam, here's a policy, you need to abide by it. I think the former, by being careful, thoughtful, patient, engaging conversations, is just kind Christian politeness and consideration. It's really a better way to love on your members and try to implement this. Yeah, there was another hand somewhere here. Yes. Tell me your name again.
Michael.
Michael.
And I just work in a kind of smaller church. One of the things I saw was like your child to adult ratio.
Yeah.
And the issue we have with that is someone will be teaching Sunday school, and I've been in that role, and I only have one student.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was teaching elementary school kids. And so it would be me and one elementary school girl.
Yeah.
Something else with the class if that situation comes up where you just end up with one student, shift them to another class, go to a public, more public place.
So Michael asks an excellent question, because this is where we get into application in different contexts. For a smaller church setting in which it's in the adult to child ratios, you just have one adult with one child, because we're in a small church. You know, that one child is the whole extent of fourth and fifth grade in our church. So in that situation, what do I do? Well, you know, a couple of different things you can think of as possibilities. One would be to write exemptions to like a two-adult rule into the policy, so that the general principle is a two-adult rule, but you recognize certain exceptions in there. That's just explicit in the policy. And that's always a possible strategy, because you don't always have all the ideal parameters as a possibility, whether it be multiple adults to teach the children or the classroom setting that is actually as highly visible as, or whatever the situation is. That's one possibility. But if you want to pursue some more of the ideals, you might need to do something like merge that classroom with a different grade. So if it was a fourth grade elementary student and he's the only one in fourth grade, though developmentally it might be a little bit harder for him, we merge it with the fifth and sixth grades. So now we're doing fourth, fifth, and sixth grade together, because we know we have also one fifth to sixth grade teacher, and we combine them together if that's possible. Now, you know, in some small churches, in some even church plant situations, you see these developmentally kind of crazy combinations, like first through sixth grade, all together in one classroom. And so the youngest ones can't even read. The oldest ones can read just fine. Man, that's hard to teach that classroom and to bridge the whole gap developmentally. And yet, you know, you've got to make some decisions of what's actually best in your context and possibly do it. Yeah.
Well, I actually just wanted to clarify. The situation that we would have is, say, we would have three students total. Two wouldn't show up one Sunday.
Yeah.
So you're left with an anomaly where you have just me and one student. And so for the policy's sake, that's more of my question is, like, should you just have something special to do on those rarer situations?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a good example of that's a leadership decision. Because you could go either or. You could go with, for example, the merger with another grade, or because that particular Sunday is an anomaly, the other two are gone, it's just you and that one student, you might decide an open door in a busy hallway is just fine. But your policy needs to make that clear, that there is room for one-on-one situations as long as certain things are in place. And as long as you've stated that, that's a possibility, but again, that's a leadership decision, because you bear more possible liability and risk with the one-on-one and depending on the setting compared to if you merged with a different class. And the leadership should make the decision then of which level of risk they are willing to take. So when you start getting into options like that, it starts coming down to a local church level of, at some point after you've created the child protection policy, putting them in front of them and saying things like, in this situation, which is common in our church, we could do this or this. Which one do you want in the policy? And leadership says, this is what we want. And they ask, why do you ask this and this? Because this one has higher level risk. This one lower level risk. And as long as they understand that and they choose, that gives you the guidelines that you need in terms of operating. It's a good question. Yes, in the back. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good, excellent question, Jonathan. Yeah. Jonathan asks in terms of how do you handle managing risk when you go out of children's ministry into different parts of church like youth ministry where one-on-one is much more common. Yeah, that's where you want to consider the book is primarily written for children's ministry. There is other good material that tries to do the same thing that I am doing for youth ministry, but you know, a few things that are in the book that help you think through this. For example, in our context, managing higher level of risk, we've got a separate youth protection policy because the parameters are different and we operate differently compared to children's ministry. And within those parameters, we have things because we don't do outside children events outside of our church building, basically. So community events with children particularly is not our context, but we do a lot of youth stuff outside of our church building. So policies related to procedures outside of the context of our church is much more important for youth ministry. But on the one-on-one stuff, if you read the chapter on screening, what you come to find is that the most exhaustive way to screen is, do you know what? Fingerprinting. Fingerprinting actually gives you the most access to the most databases and really is the most exhaustive in actually screening someone, even more so than background checks. Most churches are not going to do fingerprinting. But in a situation where you're putting a responsible adult with, say, example, a teen by themselves, I would want a higher level of screening in that situation. So for youth workers that are not just participating in our group events, but are deliberately a part of the one-on-one discipling ministry, I'm going to actually want those folks who are designated disciples for youth to actually have a higher level of screening than our typical volunteers. So you adjust part of the prevention strategies in order to match with the level of risk that we have, for example, like in a one-on-one setting. And so our goal, and we're working on now that we all have our children's stuff in place, we're working on our adjustments even as I speak of the child protection stuff. Our goal is actually our disciplers will actually all be fingerprinted, because we're giving them a much higher level of responsibility for the children in one-on-one settings, but taking a higher level of risk with that. So we want to show that we have done as much as we can in order to protect those particular children that are entrusted to our youth program. Yes, we had a hand here. Yeah, that's a great question. Tell me your name again.
Kim.
So Kim asks about interviews and references. Do they all have to be face-to-face? Do they have to be, can they be electronically? Yeah, I mean, we do paperwork for the screenings to get basic information. The references, we try actually electronically to get the information via email because people often don't live close to us. And if we don't get it, if we don't get a response email, then we'll put in a phone call to track down the person usually. So in regards to interviews and process and procedures, it's just going to be different in each context. A large church is going to have to do more paperwork and electronic stuff. Also a mid-sized church probably. Small churches, I mean, you can do actually much of it through a personal interview because you just don't have that many volunteers in doing it. So it just depends on your context what you're going to do. Yeah, that's an excellent question. How often do you recommend redoing background checks? I think that's a question for leadership and the lawyers, because every context has been different depending on the laws of the state. So whether that you want to do it as quick as, say, every 2 to 3 years or as much as every 5 years. That's a kind of the general range I've heard, but every church has been different. Yeah, I had. Yeah, please. No, please, Kim.
Substitute.
Yes.
Okay, so, you know, we generally go to people who serve a lot, you go through this whole process and that kind of thing. However, when you're using volunteers, there's a big need for substitutes. So, your goal is to have a list of approved substitutes that have also been through the process. However, that doesn't always meet the need. And so, you know, if you pull in periodically mm-hmm. and put them in classrooms, to me it seems like somebody who's going to abuse is somebody who's going to be in there a lot, not necessarily somebody that you pull in. You call them,
yeah.
Say, I need you to fill in. They haven't volunteered.
Yep.
You put parents in and or matching those people, like in our nursery, with other people who are, they're all serving in the same room, who are background checked and approved.
Yep.
So your thoughts on those things?
Yeah, so the reality of volunteers and the fact that volunteers don't always show up or they cancel at the last minute, a lot cancel at the last minute, and so you're left with the pastor expecting you to pull off childcare, and yet you don't know who to draw on, and what do you do? So you're essentially asking me, can you call on a substitute that, especially if they're a parent, and are we asking the scenario that they're not child care approved, but because they're just a parent?
Well, they haven't been approved.
Yeah, they haven't been approved, basically.
Because they didn't officially sign up to substitute.
Yep, yeah. So in that situation, what we're talking about, and, you know, we're just taking the gamble. Essentially, what we're saying is because they're a parent, we're assuming the likelihood that they're less likely an offender, but that's just not true. Versus an offender being deliberate and trying to be a part of it. Yep.
Pursuing them
yep.
just every once in a while.
Yep.
An urgent need.
Yeah.
That situation is more what I'm
yeah.
saying.
Well, but so the key thing that I'll keep on saying, whatever your practices are, it has to be reflected in your CPP. So if your CPP states we only put child-approved workers in there and you throw in a substitute, if it turns out, statistically, you run into the one substitute who turns out to be abusing and they take advantage of that opportunity, then what you've done is you've just set off a nuclear bomb in your church because you've not only put the abuser in there, but your policy states that you wouldn't have done that. So it turns out to be a double whammy. So whatever you do, it has to be clear in the CPP. So any exceptions in there, which means you can't, in your situation, you can't have only child care approved workers are going to be with the kids. It would have to be something closer to, and the lawyer would have to work this out, something like, generally speaking, we have child care approved workers. But in cases of emergency, we'll ask parents to substitute that aren't necessarily approved. Well, that just has to be clear in there if that's actually your context. So your CPP is actually matching with the practice where the exceptions are. You're right in terms of negotiating the risk. In terms of parent, occasional, you have less risk than just kind of calling on anybody. But, you know, generally speaking, there's a question of things like, do you appeal to the congregation to get approved and actually have a team that are substitutes? that their sole role are backup, so you don't even have to go to that. So, good question. Other questions? I saw other hands. Yes, tell me your name. Yeah. So the two adults rule, the question of husband and wife serving together. Yeah, this is the one that's just really hard.